Well, welcome again. I'm honored to have a chance to be with you all, so thank you. If you can't hear me, if I'm not loud enough, tell me. Sometimes I get a little quieter over time and I need to boost back up, so I wanna connect with you all. So tonight I wanna explore with you the possibilities of our practice, sort of what they mean in terms of how we conduct our lives and the choices that we make. So here we are in 2017 in Seattle. And what do teachings given 2,600 years ago, you know, have to do with our jobs, our families, our mortgages, our loved ones? What does the Buddha's message of transformation have to do with us here today? To me, the Buddha's message is totally alive today, and the possibilities he suggested are right in front of us. So I'm going to share some of that with you. I conferred with Tori about this evening, and she suggested I share some of my own experience or experiences, if that'll be of support for you. So I'm going to share a few things, some people I met along the way. I'm going to tell a few stories. And let me say up front that I'm mindful that these stories are mostly about men, because my wise wife Ellen pointed that out to me when I shared with her what I'm sharing. And I'm mindful that there's a lot of women here, and this is the way Dharma is in 2017, thank goodness. My experiences have been around traditional teachers, a lot of it in Asia, and most of those are males. And so if I seem to be talking about men, that's why, and I apologize for that. And I know what we're seeing here is the Sangha of the future. And, you know, the women here will be leaders. So this is good. So the root of this tradition, or these possibilities, is the Buddha himself and what he taught. And through his words and what he accomplished, he showed what we can be or what we can recognize within ourselves that we normally don't see. So in a very human way, he showed us how we can awaken to realizing the nature of things and boundless compassion. And in a very human way, he showed us how we can start where we are, even when things are difficult, and how we can continue, especially when things are difficult. So when we read the suttas, which is the compilation of what the Buddha said during 40 years of teachings, we can see how focused on awakening he always was. He'd found liberation, which he called nibbana, and he taught just so that others, including now ourselves here in 2017, can find that freedom also. There's a collection called the Connected Discourses of the Buddha, the Samyutta Nikaya, and speaking to an elderly monastic called Radha, the Buddha said this. He said, "The holy life is lived with nibbana as its ground, nibbana as its destination, nibbana as its final goal." In another place in the same collection, the Buddha said, "The destruction of lust, the destruction of hatred, the destruction of delusion, this is the final goal of the holy life." So let's explore what that goal, which was 2,600 years ago, means here in the 21st century, here in our complex lives in the United States. Now, here's the stories. As some of you know, I just retired a year ago from a 32-year career as a journalist, and 28 years of those for Puget Sound Business Journal. I covered aerospace, advanced manufacturing, international trade. And one of the things that made me worthwhile doing that was a chance to look deeply underneath, into the facts underneath, to see what was making things happen, and also into the people, to see what was going on inside of them. So to me, the Dharma is kind of like that. It's like looking under the hood to see what's behind things. And the journalist in me has been looking to see what the Buddha actually realized and how he described it and what he has laid out for us to do. So we're so fortunate to be in a tradition based on such an extensive collection of what the Buddha said. And I found it very fruitful to read those suttas as deeply as I can. So usually after morning meditation, I've been reading suttas for years. And I found that that kind of like compresses the 2,600 years. It brings the Buddha's time right into now. It feels really alive for me. It doesn't feel far away. And I've also been drawn to go to pilgrimage in Asia and do practice there, which has brought me into some contact with some great beings. And I'm going to talk a little bit about that tonight. But I want to base my offering tonight on a poem from Theragata, which is the poetry of the first and most elder monks, some of them alive at the time of the Buddha. And the companion volume is the Theragata, which is the poems of the early Buddhist nuns, which is also totally wonderful. I'm going to read you a poem by Sunita, which is one of these first monks, and then I'm going to kind of explore it stanza by stanza and open up some aspects that I think will resonate with your lives. And a few things to note about this poem, this is one of the few poems by someone who actually met the Buddha. So it's a unique glimpse into who the Buddha was. This person met the Buddha himself. And also Sunita was just a working person, you know, and unknown, just like all of us, who fulfilled the Buddha's teachings. I was born in a low-class family, poor, with little to eat. My job was lowly, I threw out the old flowers. Shunned by people, I was disregarded and treated with contempt. I humbled my heart and paid respect to many people. Then I saw the Buddha, honored by the Sangha of monks, the great hero entering the capital city of Magadha. I dropped my carrying pole and approached to pay respects. Out of compassion for me, the supreme man stood still. When I had paid respects at the teacher's feet, I stood to one side and asked the most excellent of all beings for the going forth. Then the teacher, being sympathetic and having compassion for the whole world, said to me, "Come, monk." That was my full ordination. Staying alone in the wilderness without laziness, I did what the teacher said, as the conqueror had advised me. In the first watch of the night, I recollected my previous birth. In the middle watch of the night, I purified my clairvoyance. In the last watch of the night, I tore apart the mass of darkness. At the end of the night, as the sunrise drew near, Indra and Brahma came and paid homage to me with hands in Anjali. Homage to you, thoroughbred among men. Homage to you, supreme among men. Your defilements are ended. You, sir, are worthy of offerings. When he saw me honored by the assembly of gods, the teacher smiled and said the following: by austerity and by the holy life, by restraint and by taming, by this one is a holy man, this is a supreme holiness. So please consider who Sunita was. He was just a poor person trying to make his way in life, just like any of us. I've been to India several times for pilgrimage and retreat, and I've seen people like Sunita countless times. They're squatting on street corners, they offer to clean your ears, carry your bags, sell you a picture or a string of marigolds. Sunita's job seems to be even lowlier than these. His was throwing out old flowers from the weddings and temples where they'd been heavily used. So think of yourselves and your own working lives. You know, whatever you do, think of how far it may seem from this transcendent world of the Buddha and awakening. Does it ever seem, you know, your livelihood seem kind of lowly to you? And how do you hold that and work with that? Sunita's life was made more difficult by the fact that he got no respect or support from others. Here he says he was shunned by other people and disregarded and treated with contempt. Now, how many of us feel that way? It's hard to turn toward our highest possibilities when we feel like outsiders in our communities are not seen for what we're aspiring to. It's painful, and it might make us feel like we're not sufficient. But at the same time, just this life obstacle can be a spur to deeply entering the spiritual path. Sometimes suffering brings the transience of life into sharp relief, you know, and it makes us look more clearly. That's the case in my life. You know, in many ways had a very privileged childhood. I grew up in a small town on the Connecticut shore. I wasn't exactly treated with contempt, but I didn't seem to fit in very well. For instance, competitive games just didn't interest me and seemed pointless, not to mention I wasn't very good at them. So I was never chosen for teams when in school. In fact, they tried to get me to be on the other team. So that was painful, you know. But in another way, it made me look more deeply. Like all the hierarchy in high school and all the athletics just seemed empty to me. And I found myself looking for something deeper, which is a lot of why I'm here. So in that way, I've echoed with the Buddha's life and the lives of other spiritual teachers. Somehow, people like that, they're not quite meshed in the conventional life around them. Something's making them look a little deeper. You know what I mean? Does that ring a bell for you all? Do you ever feel like you see things a little differently from the norm and you're seeking how to fulfill those yearnings of your heart? I bet that's kind of why you're here, why you come here regularly. Now look what Sunita does with this situation. He says, I humbled my heart and paid my respects to many people. Isn't that amazing? You know, that attitude of simple respect and kindness towards others is just so beautifully unpretentious and so devoid of selfing. He didn't react to how people were treating him with some thought of retaliation. Instead, he responded with this sort of limitless kindness, just regarding them with deep respect, regardless of how they were treating him. It also seems like he didn't divert his life with the countless diversions that existed then, just as they do now, you know, bidding us fill a hole in our hearts with acquisitions and projects or reputation. So even if we stopped right there, Sunita's life would be an entire story, a successful spiritual life. How would we think about our own lives at our moment of death if we knew that we'd humbled our hearts and paid respect to many people? Might that not be enough? But look what happens next. I saw the Buddha, Sunita says, as the Buddha enters the capital of Magadha, which was one of the two great kingdoms that made up the world of the Buddha at that time. Now think about your own lives, what brought you here right now, what draws you to the path. Because despite all this, you know, techno-consumer culture that surrounds us, despite the fact that we're kind of going upstream in a kind of a Judeo-Christian culture, you saw the Buddha somewhere inside of you. You haven't seen the Buddha in the flesh or walking down the street, but you recognize something in this practice that turned your hearts and minds, and it's become, for different of you in different ways, a primary direction. So think about, what do you see in your heart that brings you to sit here and also that motivates you on the spiritual path? For me, seeing the Buddha, seeing our potential has been a continuous evolution. Since the late 80s when I started practicing the Buddha Dharma, and since the late 60s when I first stepped onto the path of dedicated myself really to the path of meditation and spiritual growth. So as I've walked the path, I've refined my sense of seeing the potential of Buddha nature in myself and in others. And I've increasingly recognized that we can see the Buddha in one another in terms of potential not yet recognized. So Sunita, he was so struck by seeing the Buddha that he dropped his carrying pole right there on the street. He dropped it. Probably a bunch of flowers were on it. So how is that for us? You know, we come here to sit. Do we drop our carrying pole when we walk in the door? Just for 2 hours. Drop it. That's what makes this work. And you know, we all have many responsibilities, people we care about, promises we've made, families to tend, livelihoods. And at the same time, like Sunita did, we can drop our carrying poles by fully stepping into each moment. And if you get a chance to go on retreat, you know, that's a time where you can drop that carrying pole in a deeper way for a chunk of time. But every moment we can do that, just to sit and cultivate mindful awareness. It's that simple. So how the Buddha responded to Sunita's recognition? Out of compassion for me, the Supreme Man stood still. Another way of understanding this is that the Buddha saw Sunita. Even though Sunita is at the bottom of the social ladder, and the Buddha was born to royalty, and even though the Buddha was entering the capital city of a major kingdom, the Buddha stopped. Out of compassion, he saw Sunita. That's kind of a big deal. I mean, the Buddha was from royalty, he's probably upper caste. Sunita was, you know, there's a lot of sort of racial striations in India, so it's a big deal just to stop for this nameless, almost bigger person to just stop, but that's what he did. So sometimes I think this is one of the greatest gifts we can give one another, to see each other the way the Buddha saw Sunita. It's the glue that makes Sangha, this sense of recognizing our unrecognized potential in one another. We kind of see each other. It's one of the greatest forms of compassion we can offer each other. So over the years, I found that being seen in terms of potential is also one of the ways I've been able to start to see my own potential, hidden though it often is to me. So I'm going to tell a little story here, and maybe this will be helpful. In 2014, I went on a pilgrimage to India and Myanmar, and one of the unexpected takeaways was being seen several times in a way that kind of transcended language and culture. Didn't expect that at all. And this is nothing special about me, but rather about being in the presence of beings whose own sense of direction was so clarified that they saw me better than I probably see myself. The first was at Sravasti. This is a site in India where the Buddha did 24 rains retreats, and more than anywhere else was his home base during his decades of wandering. Sravasti is a beautiful place, an open park with trees and ruins of monasteries and structures built where the Buddha lived and walked. The site's far away from much of anything. It's 50 kilometers from the nearest railroad station. It's way up in the north in Uttar Pradesh. And for India, it's actually, there aren't many people. And it's pretty quiet. It's kind of amazing in India. So while I was there, I stayed at the Korean monastery, about a 20-minute walk from the actual site. And the Korean abbot was incredibly supportive. It was kind of like, here's your bed, there's a shower, here's a time for food. That was it. Actually, he didn't really speak any English, so it was mostly sign language. But once he realized that I was a pilgrim and practitioner, and not just a tourist, he was totally supportive. He just like pivoted to me as a practitioner and just had this heart of support. It was so amazing. I felt like I had an opportunity to connect with his own view. His devotion to the Dharma kind of let me in. We would sit for tea in the morning, me and this other monk and this one Korean woman and me. It was like so amazing. And they didn't ask for money. It wasn't like no, nothing, you know, just here, practice. I made an offering at the end, but there was no business deal. It was just support. And something similar happened later on the same pilgrimage when I went to Sagaing, Myanmar, looking for a monastery where I could practice. This is kind of a sketchy business because none of the monasteries there had websites or really any way to contact them. So I just had to show up. And the magic key was this email that Alexis Santos, who's coming here, had sent me about this one monastery where he practiced. So I printed out that email at the very last moment and stuffed it in my pack. And when I got there, after spending a few days getting much of nowhere, I pulled out the email, and this motorcycle driver, we spent the whole day, we finally found the monastery where he had been, going in and out and talking to people who spoke a little bit of English, found the monastery. And then when I showed my little email and they recognized Alexis Santos' name, suddenly I was in. It was so cool. And so I was able to do retreat there for 5 days, and as soon as the abbot, the Sayadaw, realized that I was serious about practice, he was also totally supportive. They gave me a room, a key to this little meditation hut up on the side of the hill, food two meals a day. The side dog kept offering me bananas. But he also saw me, you know, the same thing. He saw me, and it was a sense of support that was so beautiful, and it's kind of stayed in my heart. So I think we can all do that with each other, you know, to see each other in terms of our potential. Though I'm embarrassed to say I never got either of these people's names or the names of the monastery, but it just made an enormous difference and continues to. So in the same way, in Sunita's poem, he twice refers to the Buddha's compassion, once for himself and the second time for the whole world. So maybe it's that sense of being seen by the Buddha that led Sunita to so quickly ask the Buddha for the going forth, which means to take robes as a monastic. And clearly the Buddha saw Sunita's potential because he instantly responded, "Come, monk," which was Sunita's full ordination. Now look at what Sunita does next. "Staying alone in the wilderness, without laziness, I did what the teacher said, as the conqueror advised me." So this is the beauty of our tradition, that the Buddha gave us such clear instructions. He told us how to practice in the Satipatthana Sutta and other places, and throughout the suttas, shares with us how to live, how to conduct ourselves. For me, the continual question is, am I doing what the teacher said, what the conqueror advised? I know I can't expect progress any other way. And all that matters is applying these teachings in life and through them growing in awareness ourselves. And do we have to go to the wilderness? I mean, here in 2017, we have complex lives, but that doesn't mean this practice can't fundamentally change us. For starters, there's examples right here of Tuere, of Tim, of Rodney Smith, all of whom continue to deeply transform themselves through their practice in lay life. One of my favorite examples of this is Kamala Masters, he's been here too, who accomplished much of her practice as a single mom taking care of three kids. So maybe she couldn't be a monastic at that time, but she cultivated deep mindfulness moment by moment while washing the dishes, cleaning the house, putting our kids to bed. So we can do that in our lives if we choose to make this a priority. So, you know, wilderness, it's kind of a state of mind. And don't forget the great benefits and possibilities we have, you know, when you look around the world. I mean, here at Sims, you've had great teachings from many beings, their support. We're not in danger. There's no threat. No one's going to shoot us. No one's going to put us in jail because of what we say, you know. So this is an extraordinary possibility. And always remember the amazing end of the Satipatthana Sutta. This is the sutta in the middle-length discourses where the Buddha shared with us how to do this insight practice. But the end is this unique place where he promised us the practice works. He says, "Bhikkhus, if anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 7 years, one of two fruits could be expected, either final knowledge here and now, or if there is a trace of clinging left, non-return. Let alone 7 years, bhikkhus. If anyone should develop these four foundations of mindfulness in such a way for 6 years, for 5 years, for 4 years, for 3 years, for 2 years, for 1 year, one of two fruits could be expected, either final knowledge here and now, or if there's a trace of clinging left, non-return." So this is a powerful statement of possibility, you know, of the potential of this path. And the Buddha wasn't just talking about monastics, but of all of us. There's a number of lay people who are awakened at the time of the Buddha and since. So we can work towards that insider freedom as we apply ourselves. So look what happened to Sunita, this simple person with no privilege, no education probably, from the bottom tier of society, awakened to the ultimate reality of things. He did this in stages. "In the first watch of the night, I recollected my previous births. In the middle watch of the night, I purified my clairvoyance. In the last watch of the night, I tore apart the mass of darkness. Think about that last line in particular and let it in. What does the darkness mean to you? How are you shrouded in darkness? How would you like to be free? Do you believe you can tear apart the mass of darkness? This is important because here Sunita realized the nature of things. He broke through the darkness, found liberation. So who knows what the three characteristics are? Any hands here? Three characteristics of reality? Could you say what they are? Someone want to say what they are? Come on, you can do it. A bold person? Yes, exactly. Thank you. They are exactly what she said. They are impermanence, not self, or suffering, or anicca, anatta, and dukkha in Pali. So we might have some conceptual idea of those things, some conceptual knowledge. Sunita, he recognized the actual nature of those totally. He fully awoke to the fact that things always change. And that because of this change, there's no static self anywhere. That's impermanence and not self. And because of those two things, there's nothing to depend on outwardly. If everything's changing and there's no self, where are you going to hang your hat? That's dukkha. So Sunita, a person just like us, a person who worked for his food on the streets and was maligned by others, woke up and found freedom. So it's one thing, I think what kills me about this poem is it's one thing for the Buddha to say he awakened, but we might wonder, is there something unique about the Buddha? He sat under the tree, but is that going to work for us? So to me, the reading the words of this simple man, Sunita, which so succinctly describes his path, it really changes things. It points us towards what's possible for us. It brings this possibility into our own lives. But this isn't just about Sunita, this figure from the distant past. In fact, beings are deeply awakening now and have been in recent decades. And I want to share a little bit of that with you. So one of the virtues of me being old and having been on the path for a long time is that I've had an opportunity to meet some masters from Asia, some of the great masters from Asia in Tibetan and Theravada tradition who are no longer alive. And these are people who pursued Dharma practice with this singular one-pointedness and brought it to fruition. And even encountering them just for an afternoon or a few hours, their examples for me have been like compasses in my heart to keep me on track. So I'm really grateful for their examples. I'll tell you a few stories in hopes that these might inspire you. Okay? And two of these are from Tibetan tradition, two are from Theravada tradition. So one was Kirti Sanchab Rinpoche. Very traditional Tibetan Lama who trained in Tibet and escaped the Chinese occupation in 1959, like many Tibetans fled Tibet at that time. He was ordained as a monk at 9 and at 32 became abbot of Kirti Monastery in Tibet before he had to leave. After he arrived in Dharamsala, India, which is home of the Tibetan government in exile, he taught children for a while and then went into a 15-year retreat up in a hut up in the mountains. So I met him in the fall of 1990. I was in a solo 3-month retreat at Tushita Retreat Center, which is in the hills above Dharamsala. And Rinpoche had just finished his 15-year retreat, and his Dalai Lama had asked him to emerge and start teaching people. So my understanding is we were among the first to hear him. And there was many Tibetan yogis were in retreats in caves and huts above Tushita, because these are kind of the foothills. Tushita's like going up, and then the Hamayas just go straight up behind it to the north. You can see these snow-capped peaks up in the distance. So because Rinpoche was coming to teach, these yogis started emerging from their caves and huts and just kind of out of nowhere, all these people were arriving and their robes were all kind of dirty and mussy and stuff because they'd been in caves and huts. It was real different than the monks around the Dalai Lama who had much nicer robes. So when Rinpoche arrived, he was so old and frail looking. He had to be supported on both sides. I mean, he looked like he was about to fall over. I wasn't expecting much at all. But when he started teaching, it was like he just lit on fire. He had this joyous and piercing energy. I could hardly even understand how to fit it into that frail body. It was really amazing. And I don't remember what he said. That was 27 years ago. But what I do remember, and it's inspired me ever since, was the surety of his realization and just the vibrancy of who he was, who he'd become. The other Tibetan Lama I want to mention is Venerable Genla Rinpa, who was my very first Buddhist teacher back in 1987. He's still very close to my heart. He was so extraordinary. And he was a quiet man, and the Dharma was so foremost in his mind that he was almost like transparent. And when I was in retreat, I was in this small hut up in the hills above this village of McLeod Ganj, and Genla was in another hut about a mile through the forest. And he was, by the way, someone who'd made great sacrifice. He'd also had to leave Tibet at that time. But he'd been on the track to be a Geshe, which is the equivalent of a doctorate degree, which would put him in a position of power. He would have been running monasteries and things, but he dropped out. He dropped out so he could practice. So he just pulled short of getting the Geshe degree and devoted his life to solitary practice. He was amazing. And I was so privileged every week on Wednesday afternoon, I would go see him. I'd walk through the forest, and this Australian monk would come up from McLeod Ganj who spoke Tibetan and would translate. And in every week, Genla would offer me guidance in a way that was so beautifully pure and kind. It was amazing. And this one recollection I have, I was in his hut, which was like 8 feet by 8 feet. I mean, it was tiny. And a mouse climbed up on the altar and started eating the rice, the offering bowls. And I thought that was a problem. You know, I said, oh my God, Genla, a mouse. And he looks to the mouse and goes, oh, mousey, just beamed at it. It was like as a friend. And it just, like, it's always struck me. He had this incredible kindness for all beings, and mouse, human, Dalai Lama, no different, you know? So now I want to share about two Theravada teachers. So shortly after this is where I'm weird. Shortly after I started practicing the Dharma, even though I was being trained in Tibet, and I thought I should go to Southeast Asia. So to Thailand to absorb how Buddhists practice in a Buddhist country. Because I kind of felt like it's sort of hard to get your bearings here in the U.S. Maybe someone teaches you in a place like this, and then you go outside and get on the train, and it's so different. I just wanted to absorb something. So as a guide, I got Jack Kornfield's book, Living Buddhist Masters, which in 2007 was republished as Modern Buddhist Masters because most of them are no longer alive. But I was fortunate to meet two of them who were pivotal teachers in our tradition and who taught many of the people we now look to as teachers. The first place I went was Wat Pad Nanan Cha, which is a monastery for Western monastics who were students of Achan Cha. It was out in the eastern border of Thailand, right near Laos. And the highlight of that time was going to visit Achan Cha himself, who, as many of you know, was a teacher of Jack Kornfield. So by that time, Achan Cha was paralyzed due to complications from diabetes, so he couldn't speak. But they brought him out in a wheelchair. And I just remember the sense of presence. You know, like, was he conscious? Was he not? We didn't actually know. But there was this sense of presence. And Ajahn Pasano, who's now at Abayagiri, but who was abbot then, told us that one of Achan Cha's last acts had been, physical acts, had been when a little girl had come up to his wheelchair and he'd reached out and caressed her head with this indescribable compassion. It always captured my heart, you know, that this great being, that was the essence of who he was. And then on the same trip, I went to Wat Suan Mok, which was created in the south of Thailand by Ajahn Buddhadasa, one of Rodney Smith's primary teachers. And when I arrived at the Wat, I just kind of arrived, they told me everyone was gone. They were preparing for a 10-day teaching retreat on Koh Samui, this island. But if I had a question, I could go ask Ajahn Buddhadasa myself. And that was unnerving, because who am I to go speak to this great master? But I went to where they pointed and found him sitting in an old chair surrounded by chickens pecking and stacks of magazines. He was very unassuming and kind of gruff. So I was new to Buddhist tradition at that time. I was just leaving this Hindu meditation tradition I'd been in for a long time before that, so I had a question. And I asked him if it was true there was no Atman, no self in Buddhism. And he said, he just looks at me and says, "No Atman," in English. That was it. But he said it with this presence, this gravity, you know, that I just went, okay. I just took it in. I was like, okay. And it was a turning point. It was completely a turning point for me. And since then, I've been working to understand the nature of not-self, which is what anatta. I've been working to understand that more. And it kind of pivots back in my mind to that. So none of these people are intrinsically any different from us. They applied themselves with tenacity and energy. They didn't give up. Now, Sunita also didn't give up. And as the poem says, his efforts brought him to an awakening recognized even by the gods. I don't know about gods, but I do know that the simple practice of insight meditation, of training ourselves to be aware of what's primary in our body, in our mind, moment by moment, bears fruit. And persistence pays off. One of my Tibetan teachers, Chagdu Tukul Rinpoche, always said, "Don't give up." He used to say it over and over, "Don't give up, don't give up." And you know, that means a lot of things. I mean, it could mean like, don't give up the whole thing, but it could also mean moment by moment, how are we? You know, there's a moment we could kind of be spaced out, or we could pay attention. Remember to pay attention. If there's a moment when things are real uncomfortable and we just want to kind of go make the pain stop but not actually be present, all those things. So don't give up. Because I really more than believe, I sort of, it's in my heart, that this Dharma practice helps us see who we are. It frees us from our obscurations moment by moment. So the Buddha, he smiled at Sunita, just as I believe he'd smile at us for being here, for whatever we do in our lives in terms of our spiritual path. According to the poem, the Buddha said the following about Sunita: "By austerity and the holy life, by restraint and by taming, this one is a holy man. This is a supreme holiness." So, you know, all of us here have embarked on this mindfulness practice for many reasons, all of them valid and worthwhile. There's no question in my mind that what we're doing here is completely aligned with what the Buddha did and what Sunita did. So it's just for people like us, cultivating mindfulness as best we can here in the middle of the muddle of life, that these great beings did such work. And just like Sunita, just like the Asian masters I mentioned, we can fulfill this journey. So step by step, opening by opening, we're on that path together. And you know, you're already fulfilling just by showing up in the brave way you do. So I hope these sharings have been helpful for you on your journey. And I bow to all of you with great respect. So let's sit just for a moment. So here's a moment we can share a little bit. If anyone has any thoughts or questions or complaints, why don't we get a chance to hear from you all as community. So any thoughts out there? Yes, and please.
I was struck by the importance of presence and seeing that you repeatedly talking about the stories that you told, both how you felt seen and then able to see yourself, and the teachers being present for themselves and for you.
Yep. Yeah, and I'm gonna do my best to repeat that because for this video thing here, and she's talking about the energy and the presence of being aware, and that was the case with these people I talked about, and actually Tori and I talked about that I wasn't, she's doing this Virya thing for this month, but this is sort of resonant with that as part of kind of why we did this way. And you're right. I mean, just being present is something to cultivate in our practice, and it also emerges from our practice, and that's part of what keeps us moving ahead and seeing what's possible. So yeah, that's such a precious part of this. Well, thank you. Yes.
Moving forward, what I saw was the total trust and freedom and openness to follow the unknown by this connection he had with the Buddha. Sometimes people speak to you at exactly the right time, the right moment, and your world transforms in some way. And so I see that happening to him. And me, and others in the room, I'm sure too, that a moving forward something that's not thought based, it's more internal, and it's like this, and then the world is less filled with your thinking to think your life through, and it's more the doors are more open to this an inner.
Yeah, and she's talking about basically the radical step that Sunita made, dropping the stick, and kind of, I'm going to paraphrase, I guess, but kind of how we can think about that in our own lives, what that is, what I'm getting from this, what that means. And, I think an important thing, I'm glad you said that, is it doesn't mean we have to be monastics. I've known a lot of monastics over a lot of years, a lot of Western and other monastics, and just because you're a monastic isn't magic. I mean, I've met some monastics who were kind of coasting. I've met some monastics who had a bunch of, especially male monastics, who had a bunch of stuff they weren't looking at. So it's not about that. The radical dropping of the stick is moment by moment. And I'm married to my lovely wife, Ellen, there. And this is an important part of my life. And also, in the moment, just to be present, that's it. That's it. Just to be conscious in each moment in the middle of whatever is our life is. That's the dropping of the stick for us here. So that's part of why it's so powerful, I think, this practice. We don't have to put on any other trappings. We just have to be present in this moment and then this one. It's so amazing. So it's part of why this, what the Buddha taught 2,600 years ago, is so vibrant now. Because it's all about each moment, each perfect moment, and what we do with it. Does that kind of respond to? Thank you. Yes. And can you, I know your name, Iris, but can people say names? Because I'm not so good at names. And
my name is Iris, and I want to thank you deeply, Steve. What a beautiful, beautiful talk.
Thank you.
And the idea of connecting the Buddhist teachings from 2,600 years ago through all those centuries to us now was so successfully done and realized for me connection that I felt with you, while you were telling us these stories. And just so lovely to hear more about your journey. Just very, very connecting. Thank you.
Well, thank you. Yeah, and it was, quite frankly, a little bit of a risk, because I know for some people it's like they might have had Buddha overload. If anyone had Buddha overload, I apologize. Because within this tradition there's really an effort to really relate to people where they are in 2017, and a lot of people don't want to hear about the Buddha. They're, here they are, so it's a balance. But anyway, I'm glad it worked for you, and hope it worked for some of you all. Back in the desk, I can think all the way back there first, and then, and your name, please?
My name is Roberta.
Roberta, hi.
I have actually a couple questions, but I'll only ask one.
Okay.
I noticed in all the sutras, these people, they awaken just like, he says for one night, the first third of the night, he takes care of the past life, then the next third, he cultures, cultivates his clairvoyance, and then he tackles the darkness, and he's awake. So, what I'm curious about is there are many people studying Buddhism now in this century, and we never hear about awakenings. In fact, unless I'm missing something, which I could be, but it almost seems like kind of a stigma, like it's something that you talk about. I mean, clearly take it off on, and we've got our awakenings people, our fully realized people.
Yep. I understand. Yeah, and so she's asking about this, in the Rita Suttas, and people got awakened in one night. Sometimes the Buddha just said something and bam. So, and so she's wondering how to hold that here. And yeah, I hear you. It's one of a conundrum. I don't actually understand that all that myself. I'm not quite sure what to think about that. And that's part of why I wanted to bring in some of these great beings that I've met who I think were very highly realized. Because yes, it is happening. And there are people, in IMS tradition who I think are very highly realized. So, Jack Kornfield and Joseph and those kind of people are extraordinary. So, somewhere on the continuum, maybe. Sometimes I think if there's reincarnation, we're the ones who we're the refuse that didn't get awakened in the beginning. But that's sort of a joke. But the potential is here, and I think it's working here. And I hear you; it's not quite as vivid as it was then. I don't really know what to make of that in particular. But I'll be inspired by it, how it was then. It's the best I can do. Yeah, exactly. No, it's almost like funny, because right. Thank you. You had a hand up, I think.
I did have a question.
And your name?
Reggie.
Reggie.
So, seeing as this was a lot of your personal stories that you were sharing with us.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you had started with Hinduism.
Sure. She's asking about my shift from Hindu tradition to Buddhist tradition. I sort of on purpose didn't put that in here because it was a little painful. You're right. I mean, I don't know what my karma or something. I was at first from 68 to about 81 or so. I was more in that world, and I lived in an ashram in India for a while and had two different kind of guru kind of people. On one level, I sort of don't know what happened. I almost feel like something in my heart, my karma, just kind of shifted gears. And the Dharma just made, the Buddha Dharma, when I sort of all of a sudden turned, there were some difficult personal stuff I won't, you know, I need to bring it right now. But when it sort of shifted, the Buddha Dharma just made so much sense to me. And the things that had been difficult for me in that tradition, the Hindu tradition, you know, it's much more theistic, it's much more concretized to me, it's much more sort of, it isn't as well organized. I mean, when I really dialed in the elegance from my way of seeing, so I, with all due respect and appreciation to my Hindu brothers and sisters, the elegance of the Buddha Dharma, from my point of view, it just kind of clicked. And yeah, that is kind of funny, but there was a big shift. Is that anyone pointing over here? If not, this gentleman. Yes, sir.
My name is Richard.
Richard.
What was the Buddha's lineage? I mean, what religion did his parents practice?
All right. He's asking about the Buddha's lineage and what tradition he practiced in. I mean, the 2600 years ago, India was a time of actually enormous spiritual ferment. There were all kinds of different traditions going and all debating each other. It must have been an amazing time. Jainism started at the same time as Buddhism did. And so, you know, I sort of assumed that his parents were sort of in what now we call Hindu tradition in 2600 years ago. They didn't call the same thing. And some of the principles, you know, rebirth and things like that kind of poured it over, seems self-evident. So I, you know, kind of, he was such a unique person though. You know, he saw through the whole caste thing. The whole idea of not-self was uniquely his. I mean, he really took us, and he studied with some great masters. You know, he left home, studied with several great masters, perfected their teachings so much that they wanted him to teach with them, and he said, nope, this isn't the whole thing, I'm leaving. And he kept going. So that's what's so unique about the Buddha, is especially his understanding, his breakthrough of not-self and emptiness, and just the unbounded nature of what he saw is extraordinary, and that's part of why it's continued so vividly. And also coherently. I think that's one thing that really strikes me, you know, having contact with different people, and I also edit Northwest Dharma News, so I know people all over the region who are running groups and are leaders and stuff, and it's the darndest thing that I have seen that these people, they're waking up in the same way. No matter whether they're Zen tradition or they're an Asian, they are, you know, they're Burmese people or they're Thai people or they're Westerners practicing Zen or Tibetan tradition, there's these common characteristics you can see. There's a certain kind of flexibility, there's a certain non-stickiness, there's a compassion, there's a devotion to honesty, and just the, especially the non-stickiness of emptiness, there's this that emerges from the practice and continues too. And I'm sure in different ways it's happening for you folks. So, you know, that's how it continues, is what lights up in people. That's how it continues. Looking at the watch, we got another, yes, ma'am. Yeah, and thank you so much for asking that. She's asking about the role of women in the past and in the present. And well, even though I'm a male, this is a subject close to my heart. So I'll say a few things. it's true that there haven't been many in the past. There are a few exceptions. There was, I'm going to get very Tibetan here for a minute, Yeshe Sogyal was the consort of Padmasambhava who brought Buddhism into Tibet, and she was a totally realized, extraordinary being as much as any great master. And there's a handful of those, but they exist in Tibetan Buddhism. So there's been some of that, but not much. But yes, there has been. The Buddha always said women could be awakened just as much as males. He said that in the suttas several times. In terms of now, things are changing. I mean, just like they are everywhere, praise be. And here in 2017, I just finished this community Dharma leaders course, a two-year program to, you know, be better offering these teachings. And in that group, there was enormous emphasis on diversity. So more than half the people in the 100 people were women, and the women were basically the leaders. I mean, they just had, they were trumping us guys big time. They were wonderful. And it's, so I think there's an enormous shift happening in the West, and there's no question. I mean, it's already, there's some great, if you look at IMS teachers, there's incredible women teachers as just as much as the men. There's no difference anymore. Just as much as the men, especially in this IMS tradition. That's one of the wonderful things about it. And in terms of feedback into Asia, I mean, it's imperfect, but just recently, the first time in the history of Tibet, a group of women got Geshema degrees, the equivalent, the doctorates, the first time in the history of Tibetan Buddhism, just in December, because of pressure from the West. You know, so it's changing things there. It hasn't happened yet in Theravada tradition. There's still all these issues about women being fully ordained, but it's going to change. So yeah, and it has to. I mean, it has to. But it is. So thank you very much for asking that. Yes, ma'am. That's great.
And Pemisho started to help support a school for nuns and have to do it.
Right.
And he's bringing some of these people to the United States to be built on
women. Yep.
A special practice of where they meditate 24 hours a day in these Buddhist schools. I just wanted to bring up that there is that tradition.
Yep. No, that's great. That's great. And right here in Seattle, there's Tibetan Nuns Project, as a matter of fact, if any of you ever want to support that. So, what do you think? It's quarter of. Any other thoughts or questions? Yes, sir.
My name is Gene.
Gene.
And my entire experience started in 2017, so I feel a little like
you feel like what? I'm sorry?
A newborn.
It's funny, you know, he was appreciating, he felt like he was offered joy and hope and encouragement. And, you know, I don't know if reincarnation is true, but maybe it is. And so I'm always like feeling like whoever's there, I have no idea what they've done for many, many lifetimes before. And they may have been my teacher. You may have been my teacher, you know? So I just feel like there's no such thing as a newbie. You know, we're here. And we have this potential right now. There's no such thing. I'm honoring what you're saying, and we don't know. So I think that's a way we can really honor each other, is we don't know. And just to appreciate, you know, whatever work we've probably done. Okay.